But I get the opportunity to introduce a good one to you today. And you know we have our own Scott Sanford that serves here in District 70 and also on our staff. Get the opportunity to introduce you today our special speaker, retired Lieutenant Colonel Brian Birdwell, who happens to be a native Texan and a decorated military veteran. Let me tell you just a little bit about him. He was born in Fort Worth, Texas and currently resides in Granbury, Texas. His education includes Lamar University, 1984, the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 1996, a graduate of Command and General Staff College there in Leavenworth, Kansas, in 2000. His family, Brian and Mel, have been married for 27 years. They have one son, Matt, who is a recent graduate of Texas Tech University. Any Texas Tech folks in here? There we go, guns up. His military and service included, Brian was commissioned as an officer in the U.S. Army and served in numerous training deployments as well as two operational deployments. In 1990, he was deployed in Operation Desert Shield and Desert Storm and was awarded the Bronze Star for exceptional meritorious achievement. In 1998, he deployed to Central America to execute a humanitarian relief operation in the aftermath of Hurricane Mitch. In 2001, Brian was serving on the Department of Army staff at the Pentagon. On September the 11th, 2001, when American Airlines Flight 77 was crashed just yards from his office there in the Pentagon, Brian was critically wounded and severely burned. The burns that covered more than 60% of his body, nearly half of those were third degree in severity. Today, following 39 operations, months of hospitalizations, and numerous skin grafts, Brian has made a miraculous recovery. Upon retirement in July of 2004, he was awarded the Legion of Merit honor. After his retirement from the Army, Brian and his wife Mel launched Face the Fire Ministries, which is a nonprofit organization that supports critical burn survivors as well as wounded servicemen and women and their families. Please welcome with me, with a Cottonwood welcome, retired Lieutenant Colonel Brian Birdwell.
I'm glad you cleared that good one versus bad one thing up.
This is a good one.
This is a good one.
Thank y'all. Please, I was sitting there listening to Pastor before the prayer and the song, talking about, you know, good politicians, bad politicians, and we got a lot of bad ones. And I'm like, and then he says we have one here today, and I'm like, does he mean a politician or does he mean a bad politician? Y'all got a good one too, and Scott Sanford. It's a treat to be here with you, and I would normally tell you that thank you for your invitation, but in fact, Scott cordially demanded me to be here and said he would, anything with my name on it that came over from the Senate, he'd kill in the House if I didn't show up. So I said, okay, and here we are, and unfortunately, they're not able to be with us. They're actually on the Mexico trip that y'all are sponsoring right now, Pastor John Mark, but it is a treat to be here with you. It's also been a treat to get to meet the Wagers, Mike and his wife. Mike, as you know, I'm sure he's told you, he's one of those 82nd Airborne Mafia guys, and for all you veterans out there, you know exactly what I'm about to say, but I spent all my time in heavy forces, armored and mechanized forces. And so those airborne guys, you know, they run around, you know, we're tough, hooah, you know, all those kind of things. And I said, let me just explain something to you very clearly, Mike. You airborne guys might ride to the battlefield in style, but I'll be happy to sit in my Abrams tank and ride on the battlefield in style. You know, and so it's always been a treat to... There's just a brethrenship among being in the military, and that includes you Air Force guys. I'll get to y'all in a bit, but it's a treat to be among y'all today. Thank you so much for the invitation. Mel and I are very much enjoying being here on the east side of the Metroplex. As a Fort Worth kid, you know, the banter that's, you know, between the Metroplex, that underlying competition. When I'm always on the east side of the Metroplex in the Dallas area, I always say, it's great to be in the Dallas metropolitan region, the most exciting suburb of Fort Worth. And it usually gets a fight going between Dallas and Fort Worth, but it is a treat to be with you. It does not seem possible that it's almost 15 years. This coming September will be a decade and a half since September 11th. There are times for Mel and I that it seems like yesterday, last year, but there's other times it seems like generations ago. It really just depends on, you know, what's happening that day, or like the unfortunate news we've had in the last month, particularly this last weekend. Some of those memories are brought back. For Mel and I, like what happened this past weekend, it isn't just simply thinking about those that were killed, but you also have 7 wounded. And we live in a fallen, sinful world. But Pastor's message was exactly right, that we serve a great Lord with the greatest capacity for grace. The morning of September 11th started out as any other. I was a lieutenant colonel on the Army staff in the Assistant Chief of Staff for Installation Management. That's the Army's city managers, for lack of a better term. We handled all proponency for policy associated with military installations being their own cities, so housing, utilities, parks and recreation, all the things that make, you know, Fort Hood, Fort Bliss, their own individual cities. We handled Army proponency for that. I was the military aide to the Deputy Assistant Chief of Staff for Installation Management. That is a nice big title for Chief Donut Getter, because lieutenant colonels are nothing but galley slaves in the Pentagon. In fact, when you first get into the Pentagon, within a week or two, you get your staff officer's orientation, and they show us that 16-second clip from the movie Ben-Hur, where Charlton Heston's chained to his oar, and the Roman admiral comes in and says, "You're all condemned men. We keep you alive to serve this ship. Row well and live." Given that the Department of Defense and the Pentagon's flagship is the flagship for the DOD, those words are engraved somewhere, Mike, as you know, on the Pentagon somewhere. Row well and live, and that's what I was trying to do in my capacity. The day would usually start out getting up at about 4:30, be out the door at 5:15, give my wife a kiss on the cheek, look at my son Matt, who was 12 at the time. Nobody wants to wake up their child at 5:15 in the morning, particularly when he's, you know, about to become a teenager. But I'd get out to the bus stop, catch the bus at 5:30. The commute in Washington, D.C., just like here in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, is its own Olympic sport. And so we'd get in, you know, get on the bus at 5:30. I'd be in the Pentagon at 6:30 and change into my uniform, be at the desk ready to be of service to my boss. My immediate boss was the deputy, an SES-5. That's a 2-star equivalent on the civilian scale. And of course, General Van Antwerp, who was our 2-star uniformed principal, but be of service to Jan, to make her life and her day-to-day activities efficient and the like. And so I got into the office at 7 o'clock. Miss Minnick, General Van Antwerp, get into the office a little bit later. But by 8 o'clock, they and Colonel Williams, who was General Van Antwerp's aide, the three of them, get over to the Doubletree, where our staff director was hosting the Garrison Commanders Conference, where we'd brought in all the garrison commanders from around the world that command Army garrisons for the annual data dump for policy proponency. And Sandy, Cheryl, and I, the three of us, stayed in the main office there in the Pentagon, holding down the fort for what we expected to be a slow day inside the building that day. At 9 o'clock, Sandy gets a call from her daughter Sam, who worked up in New York City, and said, "Hey, Mom, turn the TV on. The World Trade Center's been hit by a plane." And we did exactly what every one of y'all were doing that day nearly 15 years ago, whether it was you're getting up and you're watching the TV, you know, the morning shows, or if you're already in your drive to work, you're listening to the radio, or getting that phone call from family and friends in various parts of the country. Whatever you were doing that morning, that's exactly what Sandy and Shell and I were doing. We stepped into Miss Minnick's office, I turned on the TV, and just like y'all, we watched the events that were unfolding up in New York. You see the World Trade Center, the two towers, the North Tower with the antenna mast has that giant, huge, gaping hole in it. The newscasters are talking about, you know, it's a perceived accident. You know, this is a terrible tragedy. Obviously it was, but they use the words accident, and I will tell you that there's that little voice in the back of our minds. I think many of you probably had it too. You know, knowing where Kennedy, LaGuardia, Newark are, where the World Trade Center was in location to the lower Manhattan in the financial district, recognizing that for a plane to either be in approach coming into land or in departure from one of those airports, to have something mechanical malfunction was so infinitesimal that it would hit one of those World Trade Centers. In fact, just like what we saw in 2008 when Captain Sullenberger landed that U.S. Air flight after he had gone through a pack of birds and both engines died because of it, if I'm a pilot with a catastrophic failure, just like Captain Sullenberger did, I'm going to put that plane out in the Hudson or somewhere out in the Atlantic if I have any control over it. And so there's that little voice in the back of our heads that's saying, this doesn't smell right. And that would be confirmed on live TV as just as y'all were doing. We would watch Flight 175, United 175, crash into the South Tower on live TV, and that would confirm that this was not a normal day in our nation's life. Watching that occur and seeing that huge fireball and recognizing that however many people were on that plane had just died a ghastly, excruciating death. Sandy, Cheryl, and I, we knelt down inside Miss Minnig's office. We just said a prayer that, Lord, as much as we love our first responders, our police, our fire, military, or folks in emergency rooms, as much as we love them, recognizing how constricted a city New York is, and oh, by the way, it's the two largest office buildings in New York, the greatest amount of life-saving that was going to be done that day was by the Almighty. When that prayer was over with, we continued to watch events unfold, listen to the commentators, Sandy and Cheryl and I talking back and forth, watching events unfolding. At 9:35, I stepped out of the office. You know, at 7 o'clock, all the galley slaves get into their offices, we're chained to our desks called our oars, and you have to have that jolt of caffeine, that cup of coffee or Coke or whatever it might be. I'm a Coke guy, and I had my morning Coke that morning. And about 9:35, though, I was feeling that call that said I needed to step out and go to the men's restroom. I told Sandy and Cheryl I was going to step out, go to the men's restroom, and that I would return momentarily, and I'd be back in a moment. Those were the last words that I would speak to my two coworkers. I stepped out, went to the men's restroom, took care of business. I'm about 7 or 8 steps out, coming back to the office when Flight 77, American 77, is deliberately crashed into the Pentagon at the intersection of the 4th Corridor and the E-Ring. And so that you understand what a miracle it is that I'm still with you today and still get to live my life in this great state and this great nation. I brought a few slides with me. So if you'd go to the first slide, sir, I'd greatly appreciate it. First word of warning, the most dangerous thing in the Department of Defense is the United States soldier. The most dangerous thing in the Pentagon is a lieutenant colonel with a laser pointer. So I'll make sure I keep my gunnery skills highly honed here as I orient you here real quickly, if I may. For those of you that may not be familiar with it, the Pentagon, the five-sided puzzle palace, the world's largest office building. It's only 5 stories high, so that ought to give you an idea how big it is. The inner ring of the Pentagon that immediately surrounds the courtyard, that's about 4 or 5 acres of courtyard, is the A-ring. The outermost ring of greatest circumference is the E-ring. And of course, you have the B, C, and D rings. So 5 rings, 5 sides, 5 floors. The corridors are the spokes that connect those. So you have corridor 3, corridor 4, 5, 6. There's corridors 1 through 10 completely around the building. This side of the building that we're on is the helipad side. You can see the outline of the square helipad with the response vehicles and the like that are here a couple of days after the fire's been put out when this picture is taken. That's how Mel knows that this is my side of the building. Just a couple of months before, she had been to the office, actually watched it rain that day in Washington in, I guess it was late June, and remember seeing the rain on the helipad through the yellow tinted windows of the newly renovated wedge of the Pentagon. And so when she's watching TV coverage that day, she does not know which window is mine, but she knows that that is my side of the building. When Flight 77 is deliberately crashed into the Pentagon, it's done at the intersection of the 4th Corridor and the E-Ring, at first and second floor level. The plane makes penetration not completely level to the ground, but slightly tilted to the left. When the plane makes penetration, the fuselage, the cockpit side, the front end of the fuselage, begins to peel like you would peel a banana back, and then the tail makes deepest penetration of the building. Similar to how you would take a long sleeve shirt off and you pull the sleeve or the shirt sleeve inside out. As you take that shirt off and you turn the sleeve inside out, that's how the plane makes penetration through the building. The nose of the fuselage begins to peel. The plane turns inside out as the tail is passing through the building, and it's dismembering and killing the 59 fellow citizens, not including the terrorists, on the aircraft, and 125 of your fellow Americans inside the building as the plane is making penetration through it. The flight data recorders are recovered between the C and the B rings in what's called A&E Drive. It's a little service road that goes around the Pentagon. That's where the flight data recorders, so the tail is what makes deepest penetration of the Pentagon building. Next slide, please. This picture is just a few moments after impact. It is taken by Officer Garcia of the Pentagon's Force Protection Agency, the Pentagon's Police Department. The red X that you see here notes the fuselage impact point. You can see the slight arc of the fuselage. The dashed circle that you see here at first floor level shows you where the left engine of the 757 makes penetration. A 757 is a transatlantic, west coast to Hawaii, cross-country, New York to LA type of aircraft, large aircraft, wing-mounted engines. This is where the left engine makes penetration at first floor level, and you can see where the left wing damages the limestone of the outer facade of the building. The vertical line that you see here is the expansion joint, that architectural feature that allows the building to contract or expand with the various seasons in Washington, D.C. The Pentagon, that portion of the Pentagon that you see crumble in the video that I know all of you have seen, 27 minutes after impact, and you see this portion of the building crumble, it's everything to the right of that vertical line is what will crumble. And when it does, it collapses, it shears off cleanly here on the left side, stays hinged on the right. So when it collapses, it forms a triangle of debris, and you can see inside the building on the left-hand side. That vertical line shows you the left-hand side, and everything to the right is what is collapsed. The solid circle shows you my window where my desk was located. The window just to the right of it is Miss Minnig's office, my boss, where I sat right outside her window. That's the window that the office area that Sandy, Cheryl, and I are watching events unfold up in New York, and where their remains would be recovered 2 to 3 days after the fire is put out. Next slide. Another picture by Officer Garcia, this time a few moments before collapse of the E-ring. You see the large center impact hole here. As the building is burning, the debris is falling. There's no support structure of the building where the plane makes penetration. The hole is getting larger and larger and larger, and eventually the weight of the three floors above the crash site causes the building to collapse, particularly when you add it to the expansion joint where the seam that it's actually going to shear off cleanly. To the right of that, you see the arrow that shows there's a window that is just off the slide. You have a block of windows, then a gap where the corridor windows begin. The window that I'm in fact behind is 5 to 7 yards behind the window that is just off the screen here at the right side of the edge of this slide or this picture. Next slide, please. This picture is a composite put together of all three portions of that part of the Pentagon, the right side of the crash, the left side of the crash, and then the actual compromised portion of the building. All three of those are melded together to give you a complete outer facade of the E-ring of the building at the point of impact of the aircraft. You also have the artist rendering of the 757 making penetration at about a 45 degree angle into the building. The window to the left side of the fuselage is my window where my desk was located that I showed you in that second slide. The window in the previous slide that you could not see but was off the screen, the window to the right of the fuselage, that's the one that I am 5 to 7 feet or 5 to 7 yards behind that window when the plane makes initial penetration of the Pentagon. Next slide. The slide that I just showed you, the right side window, this is after the collapse, the building, the fire's been extinguished. The window here in the lower right-hand corner is the window that I am 5 to 7 yards behind inside the intersection of the fourth corridor and the E-ring. You can see the debris. You can see the triangle of debris that was formed here. You can see the insides of the office. When you had an office window in the Pentagon, any ring that you had, the center portion of the ring is the walkways, and then to the left and to the right is where the office areas were. So all the movement inside the E-rings and the hallways were in the center portion. The office ways were on the opposite sides of the center hallway. Go to the next slide, please, the final slide. So the summation I wish to give you is, when I stepped out of my office here, walked into the center corridor that you see here at second floor, I walked through what would be the impact point where the plane would originally crash. I would walk through it before impact, go up to the fourth corridor. You see the top of the corridor here, but I'm at second floor level. Go up to the men's restroom, which is next to the elevator shaft. You see the top of the elevator here. The elevators were put in the renovated portion of the building to bring it up to Americans with Disability Code and the like, so that was part of the renovation. I step out of the men's restroom. I'm in front of the elevator, right behind this window at 5 to 7 yards behind it at second floor level at the intersection of the fourth corridor and the E-ring. I'm about to turn right to go back through the E-ring to return back to my office and rejoin Sandy and Cheryl here when Flight 77 makes impact. I'm 15 to 20 yards from where the nose of that aircraft makes penetration. Would you go to black, please, sir? So what I want you to take from those slides more than anything else, you do not survive an 80-ton jet being 15 to 20 yards from it, from where it makes penetration of the building, because the Army made me the toughest guy in that building. I survived it because the toughest man to ever walk this earth 2,000 years ago still sits at the right hand of the Father and is still working and actioning in people's lives today. I survived it by the grace of my Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. This experience was not like one of Governor Schwarzenegger's action adventure movies, where you see the flame coming down the hallway and you make a reasoned, rational attempt to escape. Not at all. In fact, as a kid growing up in Fort Worth, making jokes about Dallas, when Carswell Air Force Base used to be a B-52 Strategic Air Command base, and we'd go to Ridgemar Mall and the south end of the runway, when one of those B-52s was taken off with all 8 engines cranked, man, it was loud. I mean, it was painfully loud. Best thing to do was get out of the parking lot and get inside the building. As a field artilleryman and a 20-year Army soldier, I've been around a lot of loud things in my life, but nothing as loud as a 757 coming through my window. There were 3 pains and emotions that I would experience. First, I'd hear the sound, think bomb, and in the next nanosecond, I'm tossed around like a rag doll and went from a hallway that I was in charge of my faculties, well lit, and I know exactly where I am, to the next nanosecond, an earthly hell of fire, choking black smoke, pain, and disorientation. The first pain is the physical pain of the burns. I was burned on 60% of my body, with about 40% being third-degree burns. My arms from finger point to armpit are completely grafted. They were completely third-degree burn on both arms. My eye sockets have been rebuilt. My forehead, my neck, my ears are artificial cartilage with my own skin grafted over it. Yes, guys, I have implants. You got no idea. Just a moment of humor. Guys, you got no idea what it's like to be the only man sitting in a plastic surgeon's waiting room. All those women are looking at me going, what is he here for? And of course, my response was, this is what I look like after Dr. Cohen's first attempt. And they would all go screaming out of the building. No, I'm just teasing. My hands would have to be rebuilt, the thumbs. I had my thumbs, but because of the burns to my hands and the webbing that was burned away, all I had was actually just a little lobster claw at the thumb joint. And so Dr. Jordan would have to go in, make an incision, pull the thumb bone away, actually put a graft in between each thumb and palm to give me something of an opposing thumb, to give me a functional hand that can still grab things and grip. But the most immediate life-threatening injury was not the exterior burns, but the interior burns. I'm inside a hallway that in one moment was about 72 degrees, and I'm wearing my Class B uniform, short sleeve shirt, name tag, access badge, those stylish polyester pants with the black piping down the side, a leather belt, leather shoes. And in the next moment, I'm in about an oven of 300 degrees, black smoke and fire, and all I can see around me is in front of me immediately is just an orange yellowish glow of the fire that's either consuming me or the fire that's around me, and in the exterior periphery of my vision, just blackness. The lungs do the same thing that flesh does when you're burned. You know, when you touch that hot stove or the skillet and you get that little blister and the fluid gathers to that blister, that's what's happening inside the lungs. So as I'm burning on the outside, my lungs are beginning the process of, as I'm breathing in the aerosolized jet fuel, the putrid black smoke, that's that oil slick feeling. Jet fuel tastes exactly like gas smells, that sting, that pungent sting when you pull up to the gas station. That's exactly how it tastes, except it's 300 degrees and my lungs are burning. And so I'm beginning the process of drowning on the inside as I'm burning on the outside. The Lord creates every one of us with that survival instinct, that zest for living. You know, as He knits us in the womb, while death is the natural order of a sinful world, it's not something that we look forward to. I struggled to survive. I tried to get to my feet. I was executing, not consciously, but because it's instinct built into us by the Lord. I was struggling to survive, trying to live. I tried to get to my feet. I'd get to all fours, but I'd eventually try to get to 3 points of contact and eventually get up, but I couldn't because of the concussion of an 80-ton bomb going off 15 to 20 yards from me. My sense of balance is completely destroyed and distorted. So I continued to try to get up, stagger, and this is going on for what's seconds, maybe a minute or two, but it seems to last an eternity. And that's how I'm experiencing my second pain and emotion. That terrorism, the real definition of the word, that panic that grabs your heart when you realize that you are facing a life-threatening injury, but you cannot escape the source of that injury. When you come to that recognition and that panic grabs your heart and you realize you're dying, and you can't do anything about it, that's the definition of terrorism. I struggled to get to my feet, but as I recognized it was becoming a lost cause, I came to that point where I went from the one side of death where I'm struggling to survive. I'm still alive, I desire to live, but I've come to that point where I accept my death. There's no way to give you the words in the English language, they don't exist, to give you the rigor and the gravity of what I've just said. To step over that line that says, on this side of death, that says, okay, Lord, I got it. This is a horrible, ghastly way to be called into eternity. But I had made that recognition that I was no longer struggling to live. This is how I was going to die. And in that moment, I yelled out, being the only person in that corridor, I screamed out, Jesus, I'm coming to see you. It was not a, Lord, save me from this calamity. It was a, Jesus, I'm coming to see you, a recognition that I had accepted my death, that in these moments I was now going to culminate that decision I made in 1971 to give my heart to the Lord, the repentance that's required of all of us, recognizing His sacrifice for our sin, God's plan for redemption. All those things were going to culminate in this moment that I knew I was about to be standing before my Lord and Savior. I did what we in the military are never trained to do. And that surrender, quit, I gave up, I collapsed to the floor and waited to die. And that's where I thought about that third pain and emotion, the permanency and the finality of death. And how that morning when I had stepped out, said goodbye to my wife Mel by just pecking her on the cheek, looking at Matt, getting out of our townhome door, out to the bus stop, that as I lay there thinking about standing before my Lord and Savior and waiting for that feeling of the soul departing the body, I thought about how I'd said goodbye to Mel and Matt and that the next time that I would see them would be in eternity. As I lay there waiting to hear those words, "Well done, thou good and faithful servant." The Lord does have a sense of humor. I wasn't really discovering it in that moment, but the Lord does have a sense of humor. A friend of mine, he's going to speak to you in 2 weeks, David Barton. David and I were in Virginia together. We walked into a Kentucky Fried Chicken, and he said, you didn't get the good and faithful part. You just got the well done part. So I bet now, I bet now as a colonel, when you order extra crispy original recipe, chicken's not what you think of. So when Barton comes here in a couple of weeks, you give him a hard time, okay? One of the miracles that occurred that day, and there were many that I've had to pass over, but as you looked at those pictures and you see that portion of the building that's been impacted, the collapse, the plane penetrates two floors of three rings, the part of the building that I was in was the newly renovated portion of the Pentagon. Groundbreaking on the Pentagon occurred September 11th, 1941. In 1941, we didn't have sprinkler regulations. We didn't have escalators, elevators, all the things that we now have in a more modern, nearly 75 years later. The water pipes, the sprinkler system that was built into the newly renovated part of the building, I found myself, as I was struggling and eventually collapse under one of the functioning sprinkler heads that's inside the building. If I could show you the pictures of what it looked like inside the building, other than the one that I showed you close up with the hole, the debris field, what I would call building material shrapnel that is scattered everywhere. I'm not only under a functioning sprinkler head, but there is sufficient water pressure behind it to put the fire out that's extinguishing me. That is a miracle in many ways, simply because not just of location, but a miracle of capacity. Because when Flight 77 makes penetration of the building, it is breaking the water pipes at first floor and second floor level. So when the Pentagon had to be rebuilt after September 11th, you have the immediate crash site area that is functionally unsound. You have a larger burned area, but the largest area of the Pentagon that had to be taken out, the biggest reason so much of the Pentagon had to be removed, was from flooding and the mold and all the things that come with that flooding because of the breakage of the water pipes in the building. As I lay there waiting to hear those words and waiting for that feeling of the soul departing the body, that feeling didn't come. I could feel this liquid on the left side of my face, and it was that water that was extinguishing the flame. My sense of touch is badly damaged, but as I realize, I'm sitting there going, come on, Lord, let's get on with this. I mean, there's just no way to give you not just the calamity of what it means to the gravity of what it's like to be in that terror, that chaos, and that panic, but the 180 of the gravity of the peace, the silence, and the quiet, and the confidence of knowing where I'm going to spend eternity. But as I lay there, I open my eyes, and I can see down the hallway, down that corridor, toward the A-ring. And I can see the light reflecting off the tile in the far distance. It'd be like if you were a ship at sea and you cannot see the light bulb of the lighthouse, but you can see the reflection of the light off the surface of the ocean. The lights around me are immediately out. It's filling up with smoke. This is a danger area, but in the distance, I now have directional control because in the distance I can see the light reflecting off the tile. The wall that I had been blown up against in the corridor, I use as my third and fourth point of contact to shuffle down the hallway. I get up, I begin shuffling. This is not a walk, it's not a run, it is a stagger and a shuffle because my sense of balance is so badly damaged. As I'm working my way out of the danger area, away from the fire, and into lesser smoke as I'm moving toward the light, even though that hallway is filling up, I'm staggering down the hallway and I cover about 25 to 30 yards in a very indisposed condition. I can see the chunks of skin and flesh hanging off my arms. My shirt on the front side, as I'd been laying down face down, is covered in my own blood because I'd been laying there burning to death. My access badge and my name tag are melted, but still hanging off the front part of my shirt. I've got a burn line that runs along the back of my shoulders, across the top of the shoulders, and of course the entirety of my back is burned away because I was laying there, it's all burning away. But the front part of the shirt is still stuck to my body, covered in my own blood. I am skinned alive, and the only thing still on me is the front of my shirt, my leather belt with the brass buckle, my leather shoes. My pants have melted away, and as I was staggering to get up, there's portions of my pants that melted to my knees, in which I still have the scars on the knees, the backs of the buttocks, thighs, calves. I will not be gratuitously graphic, but I am a giant blackened hot dog that is staggering down that hallway. My eyes are already beginning to swell, the pain associated with being skinned alive. I'm staggering down that hallway in this condition. I know I need to get to medical care and get there quickly. As I'm staggering down the hallway, four men, Bill McKinnon, Roy Wallace, John Davies, and Chuck Knobloch. You know, sometimes the Lord puts people in our lives that we never really know why they're put there. There will be some of us that won't know that somebody was put in our life until we actually visit with them in eternity in heaven with the Lord. But in this case, four men were put into my life. Bill McKinnon, I knew. In fact, I was waiting for y'all to laugh when Pastor said I was at Commander General Staff College at Fort Leavenworth. I want to make this very clear. Bill was one of my classmates at Leavenworth, not a cellmate. Okay? I know most people want to put a politician with a cellmate somewhere, but Bill was my classmate at Leavenworth, not my cellmate. We were there for the short course together, not the 20 to life course, okay? I just want to make that real clear. But Bill was one of the folks that came out. I've covered 25 to 30 yards in this condition. I am exhausted. 25 to 30 yards in this condition may as well be a marathon. I am horribly injured. I'm at the peril of my life, but I see four of my comrades come out. And in that exhaustion and in the relief of knowing that I'm about to subordinate myself to whatever Bill, Roy, Chuck, and John decide to do for me, I collapse in front of Roy. This is not a place to tarry. We're only about 40 yards, maybe 45 to 50, from the impact point of the aircraft. The fires are burning, even though the sprinkler system's functioning in some places. No sprinkler system is designed to extinguish a 3,000-gallon aircraft fuel fire that's ignited at one time in one building. No sprinkler system's designed to extinguish that, nor can it. This is not a place to wait for medical care to get to me. In Bill, Roy, Chuck, and John's haste to move me, they each grab a limb, giving that first exertion to pick me up. And when they grab me and pull, I don't come with them. They pull chunks of flesh off of me, and I begin screaming at them to leave me alone. It's like that paraffin treatment that when you put your hands in the hot wax, I know the ladies know about it, but some of us guys do it too. I had to do it for scar massage, but you put your hand in that hot wax. When you pull it out, as it cools, it solidifies, and then that wax just peels right off. That's what happens to the flesh of the body. It's the fluid in our body that actually holds us together. And with a third-degree burn, what's happened is the body's water has been evaporated, and it's basically left something akin to tanned leather. And when the body is pulled, it just pulls chunks off, and it's my first insight into the pain thresholds ahead of me. Bill, Roy, Chuck, and John, realizing that I can't be moved by grasping me, Chuck rolls me over on the left-hand side. He's the biggest of the four. Touching me is absolutely agonizing. Chuck rolls me over on the left-hand side, and as Bill, Roy, and John hold me, Chuck forcibly puts his arms underneath the left side of my torso, taking chunks off of the back. I'm yelling at them to leave me alone, but they don't. In my heart and mind, I know I'm telling them to leave me there to die, but they don't. Essentially, Chuck, Roy, Bill, and John grasp each other's hands and stand up with my body weight resting on their connected arms, forming the litter that will carry me. I'm yelling at them to put me down, put me down. I see Bill, and I tell Bill, put me down, but Bill doesn't recognize me. We go through the B-ring door that they had come out of into an access door, doorway that takes you to the A-ring. They'll eventually take me to the intersection of the 5th and 6th quarter at the A-ring, which will eventually become essentially a hasty triage site. They will set me down where I will receive my first medical care from a great Air Force doctor named John Baxter. Now, I know what all you Army guys out there are thinking, probably you Navy and Marine Corps guys too, is none of us ever use the words great and Air Force in the same sentence. But this doctor was an Air Force guy and he showed up with the morphine. That made him a great doc. Okay? Dr. Baxter is coming down the staircase. He was on the Air Force's flight surgeon status, their flight surgeon staff, was not actually practicing medicine at the time, but was in a staff officer position. But he had his go bag with him. Dr. Baxter stops at me first. In all my years of military service, that told me, in all the casualty evacuation drills I'd gone through and the like, that I was the most critically injured of those that were being set around me. Like I said, it was just essentially a hasty triage site. Dr. Baxter comes to me first. A wonderful lady from the Navy, Natalie Ogletree, comes to the right-hand side, and she's praying over me, praying the 91st Psalm. She's got her Bible she had grabbed off her desk. Dr. Baxter asks me if there's any other injuries that I think I have besides what he can see in my scorched, blackened body. I have my mental faculties, but I don't have my physical. Natalie and I will say the Lord's Prayer, the 23rd Psalm, and Dr. Baxter, because of how scorched I am, the only place he can find a vein to put the morphine and the IV in me is to take my leather shoes off that were protecting the tops of my feet. He'll put the morphine shot in the left foot, the IV in the right. I'll eventually be taken out of the building in one of the little golf carts that acts like an ambulance inside the Pentagon because it is so large. I'll eventually be taken out, and as slow as my death inside the hallway at the crash site was going, my medical care and the evacuation out of the Pentagon seems to be happening at lightning speed. I'm eventually taken to Georgetown University Hospital, and that is the most seminal element, I believe, of the Lord being in charge of every aspect of my life at every moment this seminal day. The attending physician at Georgetown University was Dr. Michael Williams. Georgetown is a teaching hospital. And normally, you know, Georgetown being in that part of Washington, D.C., that's where senators, Supreme Court judges, the French embassies across the street from the emergency room, you know, they'll see the French ambassador's kid, you know, that kind of thing, but they don't get the normal train wrecks that other hospitals in D.C. get from the inner city aspects that we all regret in Washington, D.C. But Dr. Williams had spent 2 years in a trauma fellowship learning to be an emergency room doctor under the direction of Marion Jordan and James Jang at the Washington Hospital Center, just 14 blocks up North Capitol from the nation's capital. It also happened to be the Regional Burn Center, and Dr. Jordan was the director of the Burn Center and at the time was the president of the American Burn Association, the specialty association for doctors that specialize and run and operate burn centers just like Parkland around the country. As I'm wheeled inside, it's like a battle drill. A lot of voice commands, a lot of intensity, but no chaos. Mel is at home watching events unfold, and Natalie Ogletree's husband, Mark, would eventually call Mel and tell her that I was on my way to Georgetown. Mel would eventually, with one of our neighbors, work her way to the Francis Scott Key Bridge there in Roslyn, but then eventually have to walk and run to get to Georgetown. But in that ride from where we lived in Lorton at the time to Roslyn, she's listening to the radio with the gentleman, the neighbor that was driving her, and all the hospitals are reporting the number of casualties. And in every hospital, the casualty count is rising except one, Georgetown. Georgetown has only one casualty, and it's me. And I have that entire hospital's undivided attention. And as I'm wheeled in, Dr. Williams comes to the side and he says, "Brian, we're going to do the best that we possibly can for you." And I knew in my heart, in the ride over from the Pentagon, and there's things I haven't shared with you in the interest of time, but I knew that while the Lord had spared my life inside the Pentagon, the question of life or death has not yet been answered. As the nurses and the doctors are talking, they're speaking about jewelry. Because in a burn situation, if it's a ring, a bracelet, a necklace, if that's the part of the body burned, as the body swells in reaction to that burn, the jewelry doesn't. That jewelry can become a tourniquet and potentially cause loss of digit, loss of limb. And if it's a necklace, it's a tourniquet at the neck called a noose that you'll die from asphyxiation because of the swelling. But I didn't want the wedding ring cut. I didn't want it destroyed. There was no time to speak to Mel. So when Dr. Williams comes to the left-hand side, I tell him I want to do two things. I wanted the wedding ring taken off my finger. Major John Collison had accompanied me in the back of that Ford Expedition that had driven me to the hospital. And Judith Rogers was one of the OBGYN nurses in the OBGYN clinic of Georgetown that had answered the all-hands-on-deck call. When the attack on the Pentagon occurs, all the hospitals in the D.C. area are going on the equivalent of a red alert, being ready for the mass casualties they expect. As Dr. DeSimone is the doctor that's doing the triage, and I'm pulled up in the back of that Ford, and John helps get me out along with others. They wheel me inside. Dr. DeSimone doesn't need to do any triage. He knows how critical I am because I've been blackened like that hot dog. I'm wheeled inside. Judith is in that waiting room, or that emergency room, and when I ask for that wedding ring to be taken off, her gloved hand reaches for it. Gold melts between 700 and 800 degrees. The body melts long before that. And I was like that steak that you just took off the grill that as you let it cool, it hardens and solidifies. And that wedding ring is hardened and solidified to my hand. And Judith reaches for it and she gives it a slight tug. And just like Bill, Roy, Chuck, and John, she gives it a tug, it degloves the finger, blood is streaming out of the base of my hand, and I don't recall it hurting. And not so much because of Dr. Baxter's morphine shot, but because I'm concentrating on the dignity, the finality of the death that I'm dying and saying goodbye to my wife and my son through the symbolism of that wedding ring. And then I asked for the hospital chaplain, Chaplain Cirillo, recently retired United States Air Force. Yeah, the Lord's working on me, guys. This was not, you know, she would lead a prayer. I cannot speak very easily, but this was not a prayer of, okay, I'm now at the peril of my life. I'm at that point. I'm about to step into eternity. Let's go through the deliberate decision-making cycle, you know, that process and see what faith I'm going to be. Not at all. I had given my Lord and Savior my heart at age 11. I knew where I was going to spend eternity. Chaplain Cirillo's prayer was simply one that said, "Lord, if you've brought Brian here, and as the great physician under the care of an exceptional physician and his team here at Georgetown, and Brian survives and you see fit to keep Brian alive, we'll salute and move out with that mission." But Lord, if you've brought Brian here from the calamity that occurred in the Pentagon, so that under the care and compassion of his fellow Americans, you quietly call him into eternity here, we'll salute that flag too. Recognizing, that prayer was recognizing that the Lord was the one that was in charge in there. That whether it was going to be him that was going to decide life or death. And when that prayer was over with, it was with the strength not of a soldier, but of my faith in Christ that I could look at Dr. Williams and very laboredly say, let's get on with it. Resting in the comfort of whose picture is at the top of the chain of command photos of my life and my eternity. When that prayer was over with, Dr. Williams gives the order, apply the anesthesia. They put that mask over my face and the cannulas into my nose, and I feel my head tilted back. And ladies and gentlemen, there's nothing you'll ever remember as intensely as knowing whether or not that mask is being applied and the question of living or dying on the other end of that is still at risk, still unanswered. That would be the first trip into an operating room over the next 4 years of my life to rebuild, reconstruct, and put me back together again. I'm not the $6 million man, but I'm the 2.4. Thank you for paying your taxes, because that's what put me back together again. And I know you're all sitting out there going, gee, he looks pretty good for a guy who got run over by 757. As a burn survivor, those of you who have been burned or that work in the medical community will know this. What has to be done to you to survive and be treated as a burn survivor is far worse than the burn injury itself. There'll be a number of terrible things that Mel and I will go through. I'll share just two of those with you, and then I'll bring to my close a comparison with what Christ went through and what the Birdwells went through that day. You know, when we read the creation story in Genesis, sometimes you need a reminder, you know, not just the Declaration of Independence that we're endowed by Creator, but there's nothing that will ensure the absolute validity of the creation story in Genesis than to have maggots placed on you. About September 26th, Dr. Jang came into Mel in ICU and said, I've made a tough decision. We've decided to use sterile larvae because of the pseudomonas, the staph, the green things, the decay. I don't want to get graphic because you're all about to go eat lunch, and I'm telling you a story about maggots. I'm sure that steak's looking real good to you right now. But Dr. Jordan or Dr. Jang said, I've called the University of California at Irvine. The maggots are being flown out. They're freeze-dried. They come in a giant baggie. They put them on your arms. And for 3 days, there'll be a couple of hundred maggots on each arm, eating away the dead tissue, the dead flesh, cleaning my wound to get rid of the infection. Dr. Jordan would tell us many months later that had the maggots failed to get the infection under control, the last step or the next step they were going to take was the last one, and that was the amputation of both arms at the shoulder. Well, I have both of them, and the Lord's been very gracious. There's nothing that will affirm for you the creation story than to see the Lord's nastiest, if not his least creation, do for me what two of the finest medical minds in this nation could not do. As a side note, it should not come as a surprise to you that when the call for maggots goes out, it went to a California area code. So for all of you folks from California that have recently joined us, thank you, welcome, hua. Glad you got your bumper sticker on that says I wasn't born in Texas, but I got here as fast as I could. The hardest thing, what has to be done to the burn survivor, a burn injury is not at its worst at the moment of injury. It's the body reacts like peeling an onion back. The layers of skin, the layers of flesh that are alive at the time of injury may be dead in a week, 2 weeks, a month. The body is sloughing off what's going to die, what cannot sustain life anymore. You go through the debridement process to help get rid of that dead tissue. The debridement process, the hydrotherapy room, it sounds like a spa, I assure you it's not. It's called the tank. It's a giant tub of water, betadine, chlorine, or some other bleach derivative that stings like when you had your cut on a hand as a kid and your mom put rubbing alcohol on it and you had to blow on it to get the sting to go away or at least try to make the sting lessen. Except it's 60% of your body with no skin and you're lowered into that tub. And with a trach in my throat, only the Lord can hear me scream as the nurses take a wash rag and scrub you. The morning of September 12th, at about 1 or 2 in the morning, Mel is now linked up with me. I wish Mel could tell you her story because it's absolutely fabulous. The Lord's working in her life at the same time He's working in mine. Mel eventually links up with me at the burn center, at the Washington Hospital Center. She's standing guard outside my room. She's got her Bible and praying for the Lord to wrap His arms around her, not knowing whether her husband is going to live or die. The Surgeon General of the Army, General Peake, will come to the ICU to visit and check on the status and try to basically husband those casualties that are still living inside the DC hospitals. He asks permission to come inside. I'm wrapped like a mummy, bandaged, anesthetized, intubated. I'm not awake. I have no idea they're there. They come to the side. Mel's on one side of me. General Peake's on the other. General Peake, in the manner in which he asks the question and how he does it, demonstrates how wise he is and why he became a three-star general. He asks Mel, "Have you gotten your son Matt up here to see his father yet?" And Mel will respond, "No, Matt's not ready to see his father yet." And what General Peake tells Matt in the next sentence is critical. He says, "You need to get your son up here to see his father as quickly as you can." And Mel would process that very wisely as well, recognizing that what in fact General Peake is telling her is, your husband's dying and his son needs to come say goodbye before he dies. Matt would make that visit. He would come in, stand to the right side of my bed. I'm wrapped like a mummy. I'm conscious. I cannot speak. I've got a trach tube. There's a tube in every orifice of my body, and I mean every. And my son comes in, he's wearing a little baseball cap. And I can simply mouth to him, "I love you, son." And he speaks back to me, "I love you too, Dad." In 20 years of military service, on behalf of you and every other American in this nation, guys like Mike, myself, every veteran in the audience has been sent to places that a port-a-john looks like a major home improvement in some places. The hardest thing you've ever asked me to do is say goodbye to my son. It's been nearly 15 years, but it's a deep scar. But I cannot imagine how hard it was for Christ to hang on that cross and say goodbye to the Father. In my death, I would have been joined with my Lord and Savior. With Christ's death, He was to be separated from the Father for 3 days. There's other comparisons I wish to give you, but not parallel in the sense of equal, but parallel in the sense of senior, subordinate. The most basic is the color purple. The Purple Heart was presented to me for my wounds received. On October 26, General Shinseki, the Chief of Staff of the Army, comes to the Washington Hospital Center and he'll pin the Purple Heart on my pillow. Standing next to Mel, he presents Mel the certificate. Let me tell you guys, particularly you vets out there, there's nothing more embarrassing when people ask me, "What were you doing when you got your Purple Heart?" And my answer is, "I was coming out of the can." That's pretty embarrassing. But my nation was championing me. You were thanking me through the actions of General Shinseki for the service, sacrifice, and price paid for our nation. In Mark 15, Christ, on the other hand, is adorned with a purple robe to be mocked, ridiculed, and scorned by his nation. Forgiveness is the toughest thing that's asked of me here. Forgiveness is my responsibility. It is not my government's responsibility. But as I lay in that tank, being scrubbed, and only the Lord can hear me scream, there's two things I'm thinking about. The agonizing pain and intensity of such a high pain intensity event. And second, forgiveness was not on my mind. If I had the authority, just as Christ did hanging on that cross, if I'd had the authority with a snap of my fingers to be able to destroy the enemies of this nation yesterday, today, tomorrow, I would do so without hesitation. But Scripture records Christ hanging on that cross, dying a far worse death than burning alive. Scripture records, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." Those words don't just take absolute love. Those words take absolute divinity. Third, the scars that I wear are a reminder of the price paid for our earthly freedom in this great nation. But someday, I will have a glorified body. Whatever day the Lord calls me into eternity, I'll have that glorified body that will not have these scars. Christ, on the other hand, in his encounter with Thomas after resurrection, Thomas says, "I will not believe unless I see the scars." On Christ's glorified body, Thomas sees the scars of the side and the nails in the hands. Ladies and gentlemen, when we see our Lord and Savior in eternity, he'll still be wearing those scars. Not the scars that are for our earthly freedom, but he'll be wearing the scars as a reminder in all eternity for our eternal freedom. Fourth, justice. President Bush was brought to the Washington Hospital Center the morning of September 13th. Many of you saw an email, I'm sure, that went around shortly after that about how President Bush had visited with a seriously, critically injured serviceman that rendered a salute to the president from the Pentagon, wounded. I have the honor of being that man. President and Mrs. Bush were brought to my room, and the president would stand at the end of my bed and say, "Colonel Birdwell, you're a great American. This is not going to go unanswered." He would render the salute, and on instinct alone, I am trying to return that salute. I have no memory of it. Only Mel tells me about it, and that's the only reason I can tell you about the story. The leader of our nation was brought to me, asks permission to pray for our family, and says, "This act will not go unanswered. I'm going to render justice because this nation will no longer tolerate terrorism. We're going to bring about the destruction of culture that loves terrorism and loves killing Americans. We will no longer tolerate it." I miss President Bush. Christ, on the other hand, is brought to Pontius Pilate. Pontius Pilate, seeing the inaccuracy and the injustice of the accusations against Christ, being guilty of something Pilate knows he is not guilty of, takes the easy way out, being that terrible politician as the Roman procurator of Judea, sends Christ to the most ghastly of death, allowing an injustice to occur. Christ did not get justice for his actions on earth. But God used that decision for his glory and for our benefit to ensure that we could enjoy eternity with him. And finally, inscriptions and engravings. Someday when the Lord decides to call me home, Mel's going to decide where to inter me. There's a good chance that that'll be at Arlington National Cemetery. I've had many opportunities and I've got friends buried at Arlington. There's nothing more honorable to a veteran to be laid to rest in the nation's cemetery of highest honor than to have a marble headstone with your name engraved, your state, and your awards and accoutrements from your period of service. But ladies and gentlemen, had I died the morning of September 11th, or whatever day the Lord chooses, my death would mean absolutely zero to your eternity. Christ's death, hanging on that cross and those 3 days to be separated, put my name and yours in a more important place than a headstone in Arlington. It put it in the Lamb's Book of Life. Christ's death was far more strategic for our eternal freedom. Revelation 19 speaks to Christ as being the commander of the armies of heaven. While the word veteran is not used, the examples that I've just given you in that comparison make Christ the greatest veteran of all eternity. God bless you. It's been a treat to visit with you. Mel and I look forward to meeting you in the foyer. Pastor John Mark, if you'd come, please, sir. Thank you. Thank you, sir.